Blog Talk Radio.
I hate you both. I've hated you ever since I can remember. I hate you, and I wish you both had cancer.
Cancer?
Yes, in the head.
I'm as tired as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Tell me, you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
This is the stupid cancer show.
That's hot.
Hello there, children!
Hey, kids!
People seem to like me because I am polite and I'm rarely late.
And now, the host of the Stupid Cancer Show, Matthew Zachary.
Alrighty, Monday, June 15th. And we are once again live on the Stupid Cancer Show, The Voice of Young Adults with Cancer. We are your friendly neighborhood weekly social webcast, finally giving that voice to nearly 5 million young adults affected by cancer. This broadcast is a program of the I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation, a national leader in the fight against cancer, working exclusively on behalf of survivors and their care providers under the age of 40. Got cancer under 40? Sucks, huh? Well, get busy living, because the Stupid Cancer Show is on the air. Welcome to tonight's broadcast, my friends. We are here to change the world, one chemo infusion at a time, and share all of our collective crapness. Now, call me a hippie, but do not call me a victim, because I don't believe that change is possible if you never disrupt and challenge the status quo. I am still here, you are still here, and this is why we fight. Forget the cure, folks. That's right, you heard it here first. Forget the cure. Survivorship is all that matters. So welcome, my friends, to the Stupid Cancer Movement, because we're here to stay and the couch is comfy. You see, here in Stupid Cancer Land, we're not just about the quantity of your life, we're about the quality, too. Why? Because there's more to the cure than just research, research, research. The need to cure cancer for Gen X and Gen Yers, whatever that winds up meaning, is only going to come from within our own ranks. Are we on our own? Well, I said that if we're the generation that invented Google, Facebook, Second Life, and kept that guy Sanjaya on American Idol all those weeks, we should be able to take care of our own. This is Generation Cancer, and it is our fight. We have the sheer numbers, the voting power, and the influence to change the rules, because remission is not an excuse for a cure, and survivorship is all that matters. Last week's show, Sex, Sex, Sex. My God, what a good show that was. With Jason Zimmerman, our spotlight, Dr. Sue Ann Mark, and Sage Bolte, cancer expert. Tonight's show about delayed diagnosis and how much it sucks, with Glenn Rockowitz, who's a writer, comedian, filmmaker, author of the book Rodeo in Juliet, returning champion Dr. Brandon Hayes Latin, young adult survivor and oncologist, keynote at the OMG Cancer Summit in New York City, and then our spotlight, Astrid Nicastri, young adult survivor of brain cancer. So, hello, my friends, and welcome to yet another fun-filled and exciting romp through the hay on tonight's Stupid Cancer Show, and a Stupid Cancer welcome to all of our first-time listeners here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, coming at you live from the Chemo Deck, our fabulous studio in downtown Manhattan. I am your host, Matthew Zachary, 13-year young adult pediatric brain cancer survivor. Joining me live in the studio tonight, as always, our chief cancer anarchist, Jack Bouffard. Hello, Jack.
Good evening, Matthew. How are you?
I am well. Thank you very much. Jack will be monitoring our live concurrent interactive chat room. So if you have something to say, well, I might ignore you. He won't. But feel free to ask him any questions, and he might actually respond. And as always, it is my esteemed pleasure to introduce my official partner in crime here on the Stupid Cancer Show, hailing from the Windy City of Chicago, fellow young adult survivor, author of the acclaimed book Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s, the lovely, talented, and the blogtastic, spectacular Carol Rosenthal.
Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Carol.
Hi, Carol.
Hey, Jack.
Your intro is a lot longer than mine.
You read a book, and I'll add it to your intro.
I'm jealous.
How are you guys doing since the Ungala?
What an event that was.
I'm still tired.
I can't believe that was over almost a week ago.
Yeah, it's like 6 days ago, 5 days ago.
Wait, what's today?
Wednesday.
Yeah, no,
today's
Monday.
Monday.
It was Wednesday. Right, yeah, my God, wow. That's pretty crazy. We have to acknowledge our live studio audience.
Yeah.
Because every week we have some amazing people that come into the studio. Joining us, repeat offender, Annabelle Holland.
Hey, y'all.
Hi, Annabelle. Hi.
My lovely wife, Jessica Feldman. Say hello, Jess.
Hello, Jess.
There we go. And Emily Rubin, otherwise known as DJ Juice E.
Hi.
Emily was the DJ at the Ungala.
My booty is still bouncing from Emily's music.
Yeah. You and what was your friend's name?
DP1.
DJ Juice E and DP1, a.k.a. Emily Rubin, and does he have a real name?
Danny Pinheiro. Yes.
You guys kicked it. You rocked the house at the Ungala last Wednesday.
Thank you. It was our pleasure.
Excellent.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Jeffy's booty is still banging around.
Okay. So, Carol, you missed the party.
Apparently I did, but I was feeling the vibes all the way over here in Chicago, I've got to tell you.
It was so, and John,
we had Chicago in the house.
Yeah, Immerman.
Johnny Immerman.
Yeah, Johnny came.
That's why.
Yep.
His smile was stretching all the way to us out here in the middle of flyover country.
Johnny and his multi-consonant driven emails.
Absolutely. You can't forget the grammar either.
With extra punctuation everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, if there were attacks on exclamation marks, that boy would be
broke.
A poor man.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, that was the Chicago was definitely represented pretty well at the event. And we actually got to go out to dinner afterwards with Johnny. He was
the
only person that ate salad.
That's true.
Well, he's like a triathlon man, you know, he's healthy.
But when it's midnight on a Wednesday/Thursday, you got to have something greasy like a, you know, like some pancakes with onion rings or some fried mayonnaise balls dipped in butter. Like, and Johnny ordered a salad.
Yeah, everyone ordered, like, mozzarella sticks and cheese whiz and, you know, chicken tenders. And Jed is like, I'll have a salad.
I'll have some rabbit food over here.
Yeah.
Well, he is training for the Chicago Marathon in October. So.
He is, which is pretty impressive.
I think so, but...
I can't even wake up early enough to cheer people on from the sidelines for a marathon. So.
I get tired driving 26 miles while I'm running it.
Yeah, marathon's not on my calendar.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. So what do you got going on there in the Windy City, Carol?
Well, I'm kind of excited because this radio essay I did aired this week, and it's airing throughout the week internationally, which is exciting. And it's about me getting diagnosed with cancer and having no health insurance. Not
Congratulations.
Any health insurance. but, you know, one thing that's really cool about talking about the health insurance component internationally is that people are like, oh my God, you what? You were diagnosed? And people are just astounded. Like, I have people who read my book in Canada and Australia, and they send me emails, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe what you people have to go through. You get diagnosed with cancer, and you don't have any health insurance. You have to wait to get treatment or surgery, and people around the world are just astounded by what we have to go through here, and I am too. So if anybody wants to check it out, go to my website. It's on my blog today. There's a link to it. It's on a radio program called The State We're In, which is on a number of NPR stations throughout the country, but you can just listen to it online as well.
I have to admit, I'm really jealous that you're on NPR.
Well, it's really fun going and being in the big old sound studio with the headphones on and having a little sound engineer. They put some kind of funky techno music behind it, though, which...
That's
strange. I kind of had a laugh. My husband and I were listening to it at like 2:00 in the morning. I got an email from someone who said, I heard you on the radio today. And, oh, okay, I can go listen to it online. And we just started looking at each other like, what? What is this music? You know, I'm talking about like Cobra and surgery. And like all of a sudden there's this like, you know, techno music going on. So we kind of had to bust out and have a little dance party in the living room. So it's not all, you know, it's not all a downer.
No, but I mean, I've been on Sirius a whole bunch of times, but just the idea of being on NPR is just so much cooler. No offense to Sirius, but like NPR is NPR.
NPR is NPR. Well, the thing that's great is that they can, you know, this is getting broadcast in so many countries in Europe and India, and I think when you're talking about healthcare, it's the more people you can reach, the better. We've got to have a bigger dialogue about it.
Annabelle was mentioning before that Barack Obama did a huge speech to the American Medical Association today, and I happened to catch his town hall in Madison, Wisconsin the other day. He was talking, I don't know if you caught them, but, you know, he was trying to bring the point that that socialized medicine is not really what we're talking about, and everyone keeps, like, blowing it out of proportion, that if you're happy with your health insurance right now, you can keep paying it and keep it, and nothing's going to change. But, like, there's no reason why we can't offer something like Medicaid or Medicare to the middle batch of people that aren't kids or retired people, just a basic level of something, and everyone keeps thinking that they're going to steal their health insurance away. Did you catch any of that?
You know, I actually am really curious how much people are truly afraid that this is socialized medicine and how much the media is playing that up, because I don't know. I mean, it's pretty simple all along from his, you know, the very beginning of his campaign when he was, wasn't that like a 7-year presidential campaign that we went through?
It started like 1994, yeah.
Yeah, and it was over and over again. He'd say, I want to remind you, if you like your health insurance, you get to keep it. How many times have we heard it? I think the American public gets it. If we like our health insurance, we get to keep it. I think the people who aren't liking this, I think it's not the American public. I think it's health insurance companies are scared, like, out of their pants to be competing with the government because they know that people might actually end up preferring getting government sponsored care. It seems to work pretty well for a lot of people who are on Medicare. If you look at medical debt rates, you'll notice that no one over 65 is toting around the amount of medical debt that people 18 to 34 years old have. So,
correct.
You know, it's working pretty well for our grandparents. You know, at least give us the chance to say if we want it for ourselves or not.
Well said. Jack, you seem like you had something to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say what Carol touched on about the competition from, you know, the government would be competing with these private insurance carriers, and people have the option to keep what they have or to look elsewhere, just like we have options with everything else that we have going on. So,
I think if insurance companies are such huge proponents of the free market and of competition, then they should live up to their word. And why do you have to be so afraid of competing with Uncle Sam? I mean, especially if they think that, you know, the government does such a shitty job, then, you know, what do they have to be afraid of?
Well, that's a very valid point. That's my point. Like if you go with along traditional lines of thinking, the government's going to screw it up anyway, so it's going to suck to begin with. It may be a better than nothing, you know, scenario, but like, what do they have to be afraid of? They're going to offer a better product, a better service. They're going to offer more value, more quality, hopefully.
Maybe less paperwork.
Maybe less paperwork, right?
Well, actually, I mean, the government plans are administratively a bit smoother and better functioning than private insurance plans are, and I know that there was a lot of talk, a lot of rumors amongst certain New York senators about, well, maybe we should level the playing field and make sure that no tax dollars are spent, no government money is being spent on this government-sponsored plan. And I say, why? You know, our government currently subsidizes private health insurance plans. In the state of Illinois, when I got rejected from health insurance because I have cancer, I went into a state high-risk pool, and it was Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO insurance. And guess who was getting subsidized for that? Blue Cross Blue Shield was, from our tax dollars. They were getting money to keep my sorry cancer-laden ass on their health care. And, you know, we're already doing it. We're already subsidizing health care with government funds. So I fail to see what the outcry is about.
Well said. There's no real counterpoint to that. I can't really see there being a counterpoint to that.
Well, good. Maybe I should go on a little trail with Barack and just kind of stand behind him and, I don't know, make the bunny rabbit ears. And I could be his little sidekick. I have cancer. I know what I'm talking about.
You know, before we get to the news, I just wanted your thoughts on this. Did you happen to catch I love watching Fox because it's just so ridiculous what they pick, how they piecemeal the littlest things. I know we can't get too political on the show, but at the end of the day, you know, Barack Obama did, like, really what I felt were culturally relevant little bit pieces on Colbert Report and on Conan O'Brien. Did you happen to catch those?
I don't own a TV.
Well, it's been on the web. You have Hulu. You got to go to Hulu.
Hulu.com.
They're not a sponsor, but Hulu.com is like the bomb.
How do you
internet?
Do you watch
what's that? I don't have a computer. No.
Yeah, right.
Send me the links. No, tell me more about them, though, since I missed it.
Well, on Conan's first show, when he took over The Tonight Show, they cut a clip away to Barack Obama addressing as if he was like a news segment. And he's like, I think Conan will make a good transition for Jay Leno. And I approve this message. You know, it's just really like a funny little, because Conan, you know, stepping into big shoes, taking over a big show. And, you know, that Barack Obama would take 5 minutes of his day or even 2 minutes of his day to do that tiny little clip. And then on the Colbert Report, Stephen's broadcasting, I think, live from Iraq or something like that, or live from some military base. And one of the generals wanted to shave his head, and it's like, no, sir, command, you know, no four-star general is going to, you know, like you're not high-ranking enough as a four-star general to shave my head. And then Obama popped up on the screen and said, General, I authorize you, you know, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces to shave that man's head. And then they shaved Stephen Colbert's head live on TV.
Did he donate it to St. Baldrick's or something?
I have no idea what he did with it, but like...
Or Locks for Love.
Yeah, right, Locks for Love. Is there, you know, I just... This is almost unrelated to what we're talking about. It's just good dialogue to have. But, like, do you think it's a waste of his time to be doing this, or is it so relevant to our generation? Because I thrive on this kind of stuff. I love the fact that he's aware that there's a Colbert Report. He's aware that there's a youth culture that likes this kind of shtick.
All right, to be completely honest, if it were George Bush doing this, I would criticize him up the wazoo and think that he was an ass. But since it's Barack Obama, instead I'm going to say, I think this is great, and I'm going to say why I think it's completely relevant to young adult cancer, because I think he's showing us that politics can be accessible and that everybody has to become involved, which we do. I mean, if we want anything to change, my new thing is that we can't keep bitching about health insurance. We have to do something about it. And I think that people become less afraid of the political process when they see our president on, you know, the Colbert Report. And I think that's important.
Well, on that note, let's get to the news so we can get to our first guest. So without further ado, here is the with the news.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Cancer.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Okay, during this part of the Stupid Cancer Show, we announce worthy news stories to our adoring listeners to inform them about the latest and greatest in young adult programs, services, events, projects, and other stuff. If you have an upcoming program, event, service, project, or other stuff that you would like to hear broadcast during this segment, please fax it to us at 646-861-2565 or send an email to Jack Buffard, our chief cancer anarchist, at jack@i2y.com. That's jack@i2y.com. Take it away, Jack.
Thank you, Matthew, and here is your Stupid Cancer News. We have a couple events coming up, one of them this week, appearing in Washington, D.C. for one night only, this Thursday, Jonna's Body, Please Hold, a cancerous dark comedy starring the amazing Jonna Tomasis. Jonna is a three-time cancer survivor who turned her experience into a funny, uplifting performance you must see. This event is free to all young adult cancer survivors, and to RSVP, please contact Kelly Alfaro at kelly.alfaro@lls.org. That's Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y dot Alfaro, A-L-F-A-R-O at lls.org. Or you can reach Kelly by phone at area code 703-399-2936. Matt, I don't know the last time you went over to events.i2y.com, but we have a brand new event on Long Island.
Oh, yeah?
That just posted.
Yes, I should probably know this.
And you'll be up for this, being the sports guy that you are. We are presenting our Stupid Cancer Sports Night, Friday, June 26th, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. at David Buster's, 1856 Veterans Highway, Island, New York, 11749, which is completely irrelevant. This is being hosted by our I2Y Long Island chapter, so join us again, Stupid Cancer Sports Night at David Buster's from 7 to 11 on Friday, June 26th. Other programs going on outside the I2Y event stage, we have Can't Make a Dream offering their young adult cancer, their young adult conference, June 18th through the 25th, their teen camp, July 1st through the 8th, kids camp is July 12th through the 19th, their siblings camp is July 23rd through the 30th, and their heads up conference, for survivors 18 to 25 is in August. You can find out about these retreats at campdream.org. Camp Make a Dream is in lovely Missoula, Montana. And again, their website is www.campdream.org.
You having trouble tonight?
I'm nervous because Annabelle's so close to me.
Oh, God.
First Ascent's 2009 program schedule is as follows. June 26th, Annabelle, please vomit in the garbage can. Thank you. June 26th through July 2nd in White Lake, Wisconsin. July 5th through July 11th in Glacier National Park. July 12th through the 18th in Glacier National Park. And July 19th through the 25th at Glacier National Park in Montana. July 17th through the 23rd, White Salmon, Washington. That's their Pacific Northwest First Ascent that I will be attending. July 24th through the 30th and July 31st through August 6th in Vail, Colorado. August 14th through August 20th in Garden City, Idaho. And finally, August 30th through September 4th in Jackson, Wyoming. And Annabelle, I understand you're going to that one.
I will be there. I'd love to see all you there.
Even me?
Not you, Jack.
I didn't think so. CancerReallySucks.org is a teen website sponsored by the nonprofit organization Gems of Hope, Incorporated. With a mission of bringing hope to cancer patients and their families, www.CancerReallySucks.org was designed by teens for teens. This site offers strategies on how to deal with a cancer diagnosis in the family and much more. An open chat line is held on the first and third Wednesday of the month from 10 to 11 Eastern Standard Time. Check it out. That's www.CancerReallySucks.org. Next up, we have Everything Changes, the Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s. It's a newly released book written by our very own Stupid Cancer co-host, Carol Rosenthal. Everything Changes dusts the sugarcoating off of the young adult cancer experience. It is packed with gripping stories and an unprecedented collection of young adult cancer resources. Everything Changes is available wherever books are sold, and you can visit the book's website at everythingchangesbook.com. Next up, we have 70k.org. That's the word 70, the letter K, .org. There are approximately 70,000 people aged 15 to 39 diagnosed with cancer every year. For over two decades, there has been little or no improvement in survival for this age group. By signing this bill, you are supporting the Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Bill of Rights to be established as a standard for care to meet the needs of this underserved population. Moving on to cancer care programs, the young adult groups that are active and running at cancer care are as follows. Living with cancer, inactive treatment, life after cancer, post-treatment, young adults, loss of a parent, young women with breast cancer, young adult individual grief counseling, young adult caregiver for all diagnoses and relationships. Contact I2Y friend Julie Larson at jlarson@cancercare.org. That's J-L-A-R-S-O-N at cancercare.org. Or you can reach Julie by phone at area code 212-712-6173. And finally, we have Live-On, sperm banking by mail for cancer patients. Trust me, guys, do not do what I did. Mailing sperm without a Live-On kit is frowned on by our federal government. For more information on sperm banking by mail, please go to www.liveonkit.com. My sperm banking by mail is made possible by our good friends at Fertile Hope, and I would like to send a big thank you to the law firm of Dewey, Scroom & Howe for clearing up my embarrassing situation with the United States Postal Service. And that, my friends, is the Stupid Cancer News.
Well done. All righty, Jack. You're off the hook for another week.
Yay.
All right, let's get to our Survivor Spotlight. Okay, in our Survivor Spotlight tonight. Okay, joining us from Florida, Astrid Justine Nicastri was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor at the age of 12. Here tonight as a friend of our friend Cindy Papales to share her story.
Who?
Yeah, Cindy Papali. Heard of her?
I have.
What was the name of her book? Alrighty, please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Astrid Justine Nicastri. You with us?
Yep, I'm with you. And it's great to be here tonight. And I'm here to share my story with everybody, and I'm also here to tell everybody how important it is to always believe and love yourself. So always believe in and love yourself and be strong, because no matter what life throws at you, you can make it. So
that's
back
great.
Over to you, Matthew.
Yeah, did I butcher your name or did I pronounce it correctly?
You pronounced my name correctly.
And how do you know Cindy?
I met Cindy. I did an infomercial with her talking about cancer as well.
Well, there you go.
An infomercial for cancer?
Yes.
So, like,
did
if people
I hear
want to buy
you
it for $19.95, but you can get two cancers for another dollar?
And if you order now, we'll throw in your free Ginsu knife.
With Billy Mays? Or yeah. Billy Mays, whatever his name is?
Billy Mays, here for leukemia.
We'll give you a leukemia.
That's amazing. What do you
like? And a lymphoma, but act now.
Did it air at 2 o'clock? Do your tumors have those as seen on TV symbols?
Nice. I like where this is going.
Absolutely. Tell us more. You cannot come on the show and say cancer infomercial and not explain.
It was basically an infomercial where people talked about having had cancer, and, you know, we had a nurse on as well, and everyone shared their stories, and we talked about side effects and all the different things that come with cancer.
And did it air on TV?
No, it was actually, it's on Cindy Papal's website. And if you go on that website, you can go see what it was all about.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very nice. Well, you had prepared some stuff to read tonight, so we're looking forward to hearing your monologue.
Okay. Well, my story begins when I was 12, as everyone heard, where I had a malignant brain tumor. I was rushed to the hospital that night and had surgery right after Christmas morning. When I was wheeled first out of intensive care, I could not see, I could not hear, I could not feel anything. I could not move anything in my body, which I had to learn to do everything again. When the physical therapist first had me stand, it was a nightmare because I couldn't feel anything beneath my fingers against the wall, and I could see the floor and remember what it was, but I just felt like I was falling into a bottomless pit. It took a time to get over everything. With the radiation, I was able to conquer the cancer and move on with my life. And that did not last too long because, well, it was a few years. In 2006, because this first cancer happened in 1989, I got another brain tumor. This one, unlike the first one, was benign, so it was not cancerous, but it was the size of a fist. And so that took a while to recover, too. But I do have to tell you that my head was really unique by then. You know, if you can imagine a baseball, my head looked just like one, except mine, since everyone knew how wonderful and special I was. It was done with silver stitching. Moving on to my next event, I took a job after that as a paraprofessional because I had been studying to get a master's degree in special education, so I was working with a child with autism, but that job didn't last long because, unfortunately, I was diagnosed again in 2007 with breast cancer, and advanced breast cancer, which was stage 3B to 4. And going through breast cancer, I had to have chemotherapy, surgery, and then radiation to shut that cancer down. And fortunately, I am 8 months done from treatment. And right now, I just want to share with you something I believe I've learned from that's really important to me after going through all these cancers in my life and finally being able to live now. I felt like I wasn't really a whole person because of the disabilities I had from my first brain tumor and then going on through everything else, which I still do rehabilitation to this day to try to get over. And then I finally realized, actually not too long ago, that that was really not the thing. I did not need to hold on to that old Astrid that was before, because she was gone. And I don't need to regain the old Astrid anymore. I am embracing the Astrid that I have right in front of me and everything that is this Astrid can do. And by embracing her, I found out who I am and all the things I can do. And whether it be on the path that I have to create or the old one that I have always been on, I've embraced me for all that I am and all my potential. I fully love and believe in myself, and there is nothing stopping me from being all that I want to be, and there is no form anything has to fit, just me. If through cancer was the only way I could have become who I am now, then so be it. I am so proud of myself, and there is so much I want to do in my life. My journey in life has just begun, and I am going to grasp it with full arms. And going to the next thing, I also want to share one of my favorite stories in life that I really believe in. And I think most of you might have heard the story about Aesop's fable, The Tortoise and the Hare. It's about a rabbit who thinks he's so fast that he can beat anyone. And he's always teasing a turtle who's so slow. So they decide to have a race. And who wins? Why, the turtle. The rabbit, having decided that he is so fast, figures he'll take a quick nap and still win. I believe in the years before my first cancer struck that I was a rabbit. Now I believe life has transformed me into a turtle. But I find being a turtle is not so bad, and actually quite nice. As a turtle, I need to take everything one step at a time. In doing so, I get to feel the ground beneath me and see the wonder and beauty of nature all around me, and also be mindful of the moment. Smell the flowers as the wind sweeps their scent past my face. As a rabbit, I was always rushing to get to the next stop, but I never really slowed down. As a turtle, I find I need to be more creative, such as creating a different path when I can't go on the one I used to.
Astrid, I'm terribly sorry to do this, but we're running excessively late with this segment,
sure.
And we'd like to have you back to complete this, but we're really out of time, and I really apologize.
Oh, no. I just wanted to tell everybody, you know, how important, no matter what life throws you, you keep believing in yourself and going strong. And I thank you, Matthew, very much for letting me have that ability to stay there.
All right. Good luck to you. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Okay. All righty. On that note, let's cue this up here. All righty. Glenn Rockowitz is a writer, comedian, filmmaker, and a four-time cancer survivor. He is the founder of Best Medicine, a nonprofit that provides comedy performances for homebound cancer and AIDS patients. He has recently created Change It Back, a Northwest Adolescent and Young Adult Coalition designed to improve treatment rate standards for AYA patients. His cancer memoir, Rodeo in Juliet, was released nationally on April 11th of this year. My pleasure to welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Mr. Glenn Rockowitz. Glenn, how you doing?
Yes, thank you. Good. I'm doing good. I have a feeling, though, I may be the yang to Astrid's ying, because I'm a ball of negativity. So
woo-hoo!
Welcome to our world, my friend.
One or two
balls.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I couldn't help but notice, by the way, I was listening at the top of the show, there are a lot of Jews in that room.
In the studio or in the
silent?
You got Matthew, Carol. Well, I don't know about Jack. Jack sounds French.
Jack is French Canadian, Irish Catholic, my friend.
All right, that's so that screws up my theory.
I'm a drunk hockey player.
All right, fair enough. I noticed there were a lot of Jews, and I was because I'm out in Seattle where I'm the only one, so it was kind of nice. I thought we had a minion there.
We do have a minion in the cancer community.
Definitely a big minion here, and my wife's here too. So we have two. We have three.
I'm outnumbered again.
Yeah, we have three against two here. Three Jews to two goyim here.
Oh, well, the ratio's bad. You need like 30 Jews to two non-Jews, because we're not that. We're good with the taxes, not so much with the fighting.
Well said.
So how are you guys doing?
We're doing great. I can't wait for your glib cynicism.
Yes, well, yeah, that's what I do. I come into a room and I suck all the positive energy out. So Astrid was talking about loving yourself. I have never loved myself, so... At least we are definitely going to get the other side of things, so that's nice. I guess I can start with telling you about the first diagnosis and how that got out of control. I think sort of plays into the AYA thing quite well, which was I was in New York and I sort of living with this I guess you could say chronic fatigue. Just really, really tired all the time while simultaneously feeling like I could just run a marathon. It was this weird kind of like electric blood kind of shit. And I didn't know quite what to do. I can curse on this, can I?
Yes, you can.
Yeah,
say whatever
sure
you
can.
Like.
All right, good. So I had seen several doctors. I mean, I'm talking about like six or seven different doctors. And I felt like sort of like Elaine on Seinfeld when she keeps going to the different doctors and they're making little notes about her. So that they got the feeling I was neurotic, but I kept describing the symptoms, and they would take blood, and it's the only thing that showed up was this sort of elevated lymphocytes, and the basically the conventional wisdom was, or the common diagnosis was, they thought I had Epstein-Barr or whatever chronic fatigue, whatever that is, and which at the time they thought was sort of a psychosomatic thing, wasn't a real. Something to be concerned about. So anyway, but I was convinced there was something wrong with my body, and I'm not a hypochondriac. I just felt
Come
like
Come on,
something...
you're a Jew. You're not a hypochondriac?
Well, in Jewish terms, I'm not a hypochondriac.
It's not in your genes? How did you miss that one?
It is in the genes. It's just that is in the Jew spectrum, I'm kind of on the lower side.
Where are you from, Glenn? Where were you born and raised?
New York.
All right, you've earned the Medal of Freedom there.
Thank you. Good. I was just convinced of this, and eventually it got to the point where, I was having lunch with a friend, and she said to me, she said, "You're a little bit of a spaz. Are you on drugs?" And I said, "Well, of course I'm on drugs." And she said, "No, I'm serious, because your eyes are very dilated." Long story short, she pushed me to go see another doctor who was a friend I had met through Best Medicine. He did more exhaustive tests and basically diagnosed me with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's. So at the time, this was 1 week before my son was born, and I was sort of being given a prognosis of 3 months at best was kind of the news I was getting. So I kept it a secret from my wife because she had lost her mother to lung cancer. Her mother was given 3 months and died 3 months later, so I didn't want her to freak out a week before she was due to give birth that her child's father would also not be around. So I sort of lived this quiet thing going through chemo and trying to beat it. I eventually wound up being treated with Bexxar, which at the time was not FDA approved.
So that must have cost you arm and a leg, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was about $22,000.
So Glenn, I've got a question for you. As you're chatting along, this thing popped into my head. I've done a lot of traveling around the country and interviewing young adults who are living with cancer for a book that I wrote. And I met this one amazing woman who was living in Alabama, and went through very much what you just described, which I think a lot of us have gone through, which is this long quest for a diagnosis. And she said that when she was finally diagnosed, she just started crying so hard, and she said that they were actually tears of joy. And she was like, oh, Lord Jesus, thank you for letting me figure out what's actually wrong. And she felt relieved, you know, because she wasn't crazy. Everybody was telling her she was a hypochondriac. I'm curious what you felt. I mean, when you were finally diagnosed, what was that experience like for you?
It was literally like utter shock, only because the prognosis was 3 months. So it was like, you know, I was really fucking angry, to be honest with you, because, because I had been telling doctors this, and I was sort of getting, and I sort of described this in the book, like the, you know, I'm getting the look, what I call the look, capitalized from doctors, like, you know, you're too young to be really sick, so maybe you should go see a shrink. I mean, and ultimately I wound up going to see a shrink, convinced that something must, you know, I must be,
right,
you know, screwed up. And the shrink had, you know, sort of given me Xanax and said, you know, maybe it's an anxiety thing, such and such, which of course didn't really do anything for the fatigue.
It doesn't really do anything for lymphoma either, huh?
Exactly. I wish it did. It'd be a great
way to
cure. I know.
That's a nice cure.
Yeah.
And don't forget about self-esteem. That's great too.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I'm also curious to know, I was misdiagnosed, you know, it took me forever to get diagnosed, and then finally when I was, you know, got a botched biopsy and blah, yada, yada, yada. I'm curious to know if the doctor who finally diagnosed you, it sounds like it was a different doctor than the one who was going, or set of doctors, than those who were meeting the dead end. Did you ever go back to those original doctors? Have you ever told them, hey, guess what, guys, you know, you made a mistake?
I didn't. And I think because it's, you know, and I think it's something that a lot of survivors can relate to, is this feeling of, you know, it's almost like your life suddenly has a fuse on it and, you know, you're running away. You know, it's like, well, at least for me, I felt like my house was on fire. And in a way, I mean, it's been 10 years and three additional cancers later, I feel like there is no, it's just this sort of panic and running that I felt like I didn't want to waste negative energy going back to sort of yell at the doctors, you know, and say, you know, what the fuck. But, it certainly occurred to me, but I squashed the idea because it was more of a survival thing at that point.
I think that we need to have like a national letter writing campaign day where we all go back, and not out of spite, but like to educate our doctors, just let them know, hey, by the way, you missed this. Next time, maybe you should look for this. Because it's
great
true
idea.
What you said. I mean, how many of us have the energy when the shit hits the fan to go back and, like, duke it out with your doctors or take a moment to educate your doctors? You know, I mean, it's not what you do when you're in survival mode. But
exactly.
I think there's just such an amazing opportunity. I haven't done it either. I'm not even sure that I could track down my doctors from that point in time.
Well, Carol, do you know about my Robitussin brain cancer story?
Dude, tell.
This is the famous Matthew Zachary Robitussin.
I know, but
story.
Everyone needs to know.
I don't know that story.
Well, I mean, to put things in perspective, this was in the sort of Stone Age in 1995, but when I was a college senior, I started to experience neuropathy in my left hand, and as a pianist, I noticed it right away, but I went to the doctors, and they thought I had anything from carpal tunnel syndrome to a mini-stroke to they thought I had onset multiple sclerosis, and ultimately they diagnosed me with Epstein-Barr and thought I was coming out with the flu and gave me Robitussin.
My
campus physician's over 3.5 months. Meanwhile, I was starting to, like, vomit, and I was starting to fall down and faint. My vision went blurry. I started slurring my speech, and they gave me Robitussin, told me I had Epstein-Barr and was getting the flu.
Jesus Christ.
So if
incredible.
I could only go back to those fuckers and say, douchebags.
Yeah, really. Really.
I wonder if the Epstein-Barr instances have increased from so many doctors misdiagnosing young adults with cancer as having Epstein-Barr.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big thing with me.
Sounds like
I was a trendsetter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's interesting because mine was 99, but it seems to me, and maybe Brandon can correct me on this, your next guest, but it seems that they have sort of drawn some line between Epstein-Barr or the elevated lymphocytes that were giving that diagnosis to linked it to sort of as a precursor to non-Hodgkin's or Hodgkin's. So I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's just something I made up. If it's something I made up, it's fantastic. So,
It's really great. Well, my doctors are still telling me that I made everything up, because even after I was diagnosed, I was like, thank God. Now I know why for the last year and a half I was so fatigued that I'd get up in the morning, brush my teeth, and would have to fall asleep on the bathroom floor underneath the sink because I couldn't get back to my bed. And they said to me, oh, no, the two have nothing to do with each other. We still have no idea why you weren't feeling well for a year and a half. Come on, God. So, yeah, I never got the satisfaction. So, when and how did you break the news to your lovely wife?
I wish this was a good story, something I could be proud of.
You still haven't told her?
Exactly. She's finding out through this podcast. I hope that's okay.
I hope she's not listening.
That's your voice.
Awkward.
Yeah, exactly.
Put a light sheet into his living room.
I was ironically going to speak at a I was asked to speak at a conference about laughter and healing, and I was going. Nobody at the conference knew that I was living on borrowed time at the time, and I decided that I would tell her. She and my son, who was 2 months old, flew to Arizona, and I got it in my head in the middle of the flight that would be a good time to tell her. So yes, I am a piece of shit. But
did she jump out of the plane?
Yeah, she did. She did. She survived, which is really an interesting story. No, I mean, you know, it was honestly, I have very little recollection of it as does she. I mean, we've spoken about it since, and it was almost like a blur because it was a shock to say it. I don't know why I was suddenly overcome with the need to say it at that point. You know, she was definitely, she didn't speak to me for a number of days, and who could blame her, so.
And you're still together?
No, we are divorced.
Oh, boy. Did you have a Jewish lawyer?
So sorry for laughing,
but,
you know.
Yeah. So, it seems like, I'm a total catch, right? You can figure, why would she not want to stay with that person? But.
So, I mean, talk about the delayed diagnosis part of your story, and do you think that changes how you approach cancer? I mean, I think a lot of young adults are extremely feisty and savvy in the medical world because we had to fight so hard just to get diagnosed. It's not like our, you know, grandparents, they come out and they're just like, oh, you don't feel well? Well, let's say, oh, you have cancer. It's like, no, we're, you know, pissing and screaming for years before we're diagnosed, and we kind of, you know, we've learned how to navigate the system before we even get our diagnosis. So how do you think it's affected the way that you've sought treatment or?
Well, I mean, I would definitely say, I mean, it's sort of instilled this hypervigilance in me, which was just constant awareness of everything that was going on in my body. And I mean, and it's weird because, I mean, I'm sure you guys can relate to this, suddenly being in the medical system and then being under surveillance is a weird kind of blessing because you're able to catch future cancers early, you know, I have so many horror stories that you wouldn't have enough time to talk about it, but it's because I'm so hypervigilant now, you know, I've gotten to the point where I can more or less, you know, look at films and see what I'm looking for, and you know, I'm just always super aware of it, and it's become somewhat of a passion of a crusade of mine to whenever I notice there are any kind of similar symptoms in anybody. You know, any young people, I always, you know, I sort of tell them my story as a cautionary tale, and, you know, I'm sure 95% of the time it turns out to be nothing with them, but you know, it's so easy. To this day, I still think young patients get written off so easily as, you know, just you're too young, you know. And,
when you say that you tell it as a cautionary tale, how do you do that in a way that doesn't just completely freak people out? I mean, I always watch this thin line that I have with my story, too. It's just, you know, wanting to educate people but also not wanting to scare the shit out of folks that they never go to the doctor because they're terrified it's just going to be cancer. So, you know, die in the
I do exactly what you're saying in the sense that I purposely try to scare the shit out of them because I do think that people tend to be motivated, especially young people, tend to be motivated by fear. I mean, it's like in a way.
Works for the government.
Yeah, exactly. Worked for George Bush for a long time. But you know, I do think that that's a motivator. At least the people that, you know, the people that I've been concerned about or have mentioned it to, you know, I've sort of. you know, the reality of the story is scary, and I think sometimes it's very easy to just ignore things and just assume it's nothing. Even, you know, that same ignorance goes across the patient line too. I mean, you say to yourself, "I'm too young; it can't be anything," and you ignore symptoms that way. And so, and I think to your point, you know, the young patients are so good about, you know, they just sort of need the go ahead. And I think if getting them scared and getting them to get a baseline scan, I think is actually a good thing, because it kind of puts them on the map and has something to judge against in the future. So I don't mind scaring people if it means in the long term saving people, you know. But I understand. I totally get your point.
Yeah. Before we bring Brandon on, I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about your book.
Yes, I would love to. The book is called Rodeo and Joliet, and basically the story behind the book, which is not just the story behind
the title. You
spelled
it wrong, by the way.
What's that?
You spelled it wrong. It's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, right. God damn it. It's so funny. I may have spelled the author's name wrong, too. If
right.
It's Rockwitz, it should be Shakespeare, so I apologize. But it basically, the title comes from, I was going through chemo with a guy who was an ex-con who had been in Joliet prison for 14 years, and he was telling me, he was a really lovely guy, and I mean that in the most sarcastic way I can say, but he was telling me this lovely ritual they had in prison where whenever a new patient would come, or new patient, that's a slip, a new inmate would come to prison, they would have this sort of preconceived notion of what prison was like, and all the prisoners had an agreement they were going to let the new guy feel safe for 3 days. And then on that fourth day, they would surround him and do horrible things to that person, and then give them a little fresh fish. Yeah, exactly, and give them a second to get up and then do it again. And it occurred to me in the writing of the book that it was really the perfect metaphor for what cancer has been for me, in the sense that every time I feel like it's safe, there's never really that feeling of being safe again. And, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, that that's a common thing. I don't know if it's a common thing with other survivors, but it certainly has been with me, because there hasn't been a stretch of time where I have been cancer-free. But the gist of the book is it starts with me getting diagnosed. And then my father prays to God. He's a devout atheist. He prays to God that he gets cancer so that I can live. And 7 days later, he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And obviously having nothing to do with that, but nonetheless, it's a weight to carry. And he died shortly after I had finished treatment and was told that I was in remission. So, you know, the weird timing on everything, and just the experience. You know, I wanted to write a book that was visceral, that described in real time, first person, what was going through my head at the time. You know, it's a memoir, so it's narrative nonfiction. It's you know, it's I think it's fairly intense, but it's also got its funny moments. It's just one of those things where, when I was sick, there never seemed to be a book that would sort of lay it on the line and say what it was. Like, it was always about getting back to gardening and you know, it's a very Oprah-fied thing. So I decided if I was lucky enough to survive, I would write an account of this time of my life for my son and you know, to sort of future cancer patients, to let them know, you know, that you can, I believe, you know, if you can't ultimately win the rodeo, you can certainly extend it for many, many years by just being vigilant and staying on top of things and, you know, being your own advocate, because I feel like that's the only way I've managed to save my life many times over.
So it's Rodeo and Joliet, and it's where is it available? Is it on the shelves yet, or it's soon to be out?
It's not on the shelves yet. It's on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon now, and the official release will be in October.
Excellent.
All right, well, we're going to run over because we're going to bring in Brandon now, and they'll have the two of you in the chat room. So let me give him this very appropriate intro here. Our returning champion tonight, Dr. Brandon Hayes Latin, is the Stupid Cancer Movement's resident young adult survivor celebra oncologist. He is an assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology and is the director of the OHSU Knight Cancer Center Institute's Adolescent and Young Adult Oncology Program. A testicular cancer survivor, he is one of the few docs who has taken a leadership role in the development of a new discipline of AYA oncology and serves as the inaugural medical co-chair of the Lance Armstrong Foundation's Live Strong Young Adult Alliance. Please welcome to the, where is he? Where'd he go? Where'd Brandon go? Brandon, there he is. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Brandon Hayes-Ladin. Couldn't find you in the switchboard, bro. There you are.
I'm right here. How's it going, guys?
All righty. Now, Brandon, I asked Glenn this, but I want to see if you can corroborate. How do you know each other?
How do I know Glenn?
Yeah.
Glenn Rockowitz appeared out of nowhere to the Adolescent Young Adult Oncology Program at my Knight Cancer Institute as an anonymous donor. And
nice job, by the way.
And
it turns out
that that Glenn has been doing all sorts of behind the scenes work to promote AYA oncology in the Pacific Northwest.
Sweet.
And so eventually we met and have all kinds of grand plans to change the world.
Does it involve was it sharks with frickin' laser guns on them?
Whatever it takes.
Okay, good stuff. That's the only kind that's ever going to work is sharks with frickin' laser guns on them. So,
Glenn's a real AYA oncology champion, both in terms of fundraising and awareness. And, you know, the guy is straight up. He's honest. He tells it like it is, and we really appreciate that.
Now, do you have a Robitussin for brain cancer story of your diagnosis? I don't remember asking.
Of my own diagnosis. So, I was a physician at the time of my own diagnosis and diagnosed myself by finding a mass where it shouldn't be. A mass in a testicle for a young male is cancer until proven otherwise, and I knew that. So even before I was diagnosed, I knew exactly what it was.
So is the moral of this that everyone has to become a doctor?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
No, I mean, the bottom line, and you guys hit on this before, is the ability to consider cancer, whether you're the patient and you think, you know, that ache or that pain or that symptom has gone on too long, that, you know, all of us get colds or the flu and all of us, you know, sprain an ankle and, you know, common things are common. But when things don't play out the way they should, when things last longer than they should or the intensity is different or, you know, you've had something 10 times before, but there's something about this time that's different, you need to consider that it could be a serious health condition, whether it's cancer or otherwise, and seek attention. But then the flip side is on the provider side, is that when a young person comes in with a common symptom, you also need to keep, you know, in medical field we call it a broad differential diagnosis. You need to think, well, yeah, common things are common, but what else could it be? For any one symptom, there's a whole host of diagnoses that might fit. And sure, mono is common among young adults, and there's lots of fatigue and, you know, non-specific symptoms that go along with Epstein-Barr virus and mono. But you need to think broadly, and if things aren't, you know, resolving in the normal time frame, or the intensity level's different, or there are certain red flags, that the providers need to consider cancer. And in fact, there have been studies. I think the best example was a study done in Canada where, you know, with a National Health Service, there was sort of access to care was taken out of the equation. And it turns out that for young adults compared to kids, there was a longer time from the start of symptoms to making a diagnosis. From the start of symptoms to seeking medical attention for young adults compared to kids. But there was also a longer time from seeking medical attention to actually getting a cancer diagnosis. So I think, you know, both patients and providers need to consider cancer.
Is it easier then? I ask this question all the time. Is it easier to convince the 19-year-old that they're not invincible, or is it easier to help sort of the next generation of doctors that are, you know, residents and fellows now in their 20s and 30s to have more symptom literacy for their own age group?
Let me make sure I got your question right. You're saying is it easier to sort of educate and inform the patients versus the providers?
Right. I mean, cause,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously the providers are a more captive audience.
Right.
We have a whole host of providers, whether that be physicians or nurses or, you know, therapists who are going to run into young adult patients. We need to reach all of them, and that should be part of a standardized curriculum for anybody who deals with young adults as part of their practice. They need to learn the basics of AYA oncology. And that's one of the, you know, core initiatives of the Live Strong Young Adult Alliance. But I think it's got to be both. I think that, you know, radio programs like the Stupid Cancer Show and books like Rodeo and Juliet are going to continue to get the message out to the public that, whoa, cancer actually happens in young adults. And I need
We want the oncologists to know how to treat young adults who are, how to diagnose them correctly, I suppose. But, you know, how do you get the university physician that gives a 21-year-old Robitussin for brain cancer, you know, how do you get that level, that first entry point general practitioner to have that literacy? Or is that along the lines of, you know, you can't become an oncologist until you obviously train in different subspecialties. But at what point in that process?
Yeah, no, it's definitely the primary care, the front lines that needed to get this education. I mean, I'm an oncologist. People don't come to me with these symptoms. People come
right.
to me with diagnosis. No,
right.
you're absolutely right. We're targeting primary care.
Okay, Glenn, what is your take? And Carol, chime in here anytime. What do you think is going to ultimately? I mean, obviously, it's going to be a complex array of solutions, but where's the biggest bang for the buck in terms of rallying our generation?
Boy, that's a
tough one. Go for it, Glenn.
That's a tough one. I speak for a generation. And this is that cynicism that you were sort of worried about. You know, I feel like the way the world works electronically now, I think it sort of feels like it could be easier. But in fact, I think there's a whole generation of apathetic young people. And I think they're going to be harder to get through to, than traditionally you have. I mean, I don't know ultimately how that's going to happen, if it's scaring the shit out of them, letting them know the reality, giving them a checklist of things to make sure they get checked out or aware of. I don't know. But God, I can only hope that this generation, I sound like I'm 80, this generation has a better time at it. You know, I just don't know. I don't know what that is. I mean, I think, like, you know, your show is a perfect example of ways and, you know, that can affect that. I guess my question would be, like, are the people tuning into the show, are they people who have already diagnosed? You know,
absolutely. I think that there's a preaching to the choir trap to some of this, is that we have to make sure that, you know, we're using the sort of non-cancer supportive routes to educate people, because folks who are already connected to cancer support are those of us who already have it, who are diagnosed
too
late.
I guess if you could give a vitamin B shot to the in crowd already and just juice them up to spread that in the sense, like 5-10 years ago, there was no young adult movement in the sense that there is now, especially in the wake of, you know, the NCI public health indoctrination. But to that extent, I always like to say, you know, change comes slowly and only from within. I think the impetus, and I'm just as cynical as you, Glenn, I take a slightly more positive spin when I see these kinds of conversation happening in the first place, because they wouldn't even be happening to begin with 10 years ago. The fact that we are preaching to the choir is, I think, step one. You know, you ever see that South Park with the underpants gnomes? I might be dating myself. It was season 2.
I know it.
Okay. Yeah, it's like collect underpants was stage 1. There was no stage 2, but stage 3 was profit. And it didn't matter what stage 2 was. But I think that we've reached the stage 1 where we know what we've got, what to do, and we know what stage 3 is. We don't quite know what stage 2 is.
Right. No, it's a very good point. Absolutely. Absolutely agree with that. I mean, you know, I wish I had the answer for that. I mean, I think things that, like, what Brandon's doing, you know, pretty much every day. I mean, you know, I have to say that, like, getting onto Twitter, where, you know, I mean, I'm definitely not the target demographic, I think, but getting on it and, like, the the speed at which information is transferred. And, you know, like Brandon's, you know, I think the username is Hazelat. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
On Twitter, you know, and Heidi as well from Planet Cancer, I'm hooked into them, and I'm following them, and it seems like every 10 minutes there's another article, and I'm becoming more and more educated. The question is, how do you get that same information to young people, you know, who may not be as interested in?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of power in face-to-face conversations, and I make sure that I talk about my cancer to people who I do not know and that I'm talking to face-to-face. So, you know, for example, I often think about the time I went into Sephora to try to find a tube of lipstick that didn't have parabens in it. And someone's like, paraben? What's a paraben? And so I told her what a paraben was, and she's like, why do you care? It's just on your lips. It's not like you're eating it. And I was like, well, because I have cancer, and this is why I want to lower the amount of toxic shit that's going to my bloodstream. And, you know, I didn't say it in an in-your-face way. I said it in a sort of educational way of like, hey, you know, I'm a young woman, and guess what? I have cancer. And the look on your face of shock and horror, it's a good thing for you to know about because you probably have some daughters my age, and you should know that they could potentially have cancer too. So the next time that their doctor tells them that it's nothing, it might be something. And I think that that's, you know, I think that a lot of young adults, cancer patients are often emailing me, you know, I want to write a book, how do I write a book? And it's great to write a book, but it's not the only way to tell your story. You know, you can tell your story to the person who's standing next to you at the bus stop, and that is just as important. And I think that part of it is just making ourselves into these walking billboards where people can actually see and recognize that cancer does happen in young adults so that they will think about it.
Absolutely. It's absolutely true. I mean, and you know, I had worked on an ad campaign of TV spots that I had done for Brandon over at OHSU. You know, and the thing about the TV spots were that they were sort of a kick in the teeth, in that they depict, you know, young people. I mean, they're, you know, we used actual patients, you know, in a very real, quiet way. But it's sort of like, God, you just never think. You know, the general population just never thinks of cancer as being, you know, a 20, 25-year-old guy or you know, 20-year-old girl. So, you know, I think that kind of advertising, while it may not be popular with some people in the cancer community, I think it's like sort of a wake-up call to people who are not affected necessarily, and to say, you know, not to scare them, you know, not a fear thing, but like, hey, this does happen. So just general education that way, I think, is an important thing.
Well, another thing that I want to bring up, because I just, you know, I never talk about health insurance ever, and it's really, I'm being sarcastic because it's the only thing I really feel like I ever talk about, but, you know, I think as equally important in this equation to educating doctors and educating patients is health insurance, because if we are having to get to the doctors not once but 10 times in order to get diagnosed, if we don't have health insurance, we cannot do that. And
Absolutely.
Often young adults, because we can't afford health insurance, if we can, we at least opt for some kind of catastrophic coverage.
Absolutely.
Well, catastrophic coverage doesn't kick in until you know that you've got the catastrophe going on.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, we need to be able to gain access to getting into the system so that we can get our diagnosis. And I think that that needs to go along side by side with our increasing awareness.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and just to that point, I mean, when I was, I stopped going to doctors because I no longer had the money to pay out of pocket to see if I could track down what was wrong with me. And at a certain point, I gave up. It was a combination of just general, you know, starting to believe that maybe nothing was wrong with me. But it definitely was a decision. I mean, I remember distinctly the last doctor I went to and paying cash because I had no health insurance, and saying, you know what, even if it is something, there's nothing I can do about it now because I have no money. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's a hugely important thing, and it's definitely something that it just seems like such a behemoth to tackle, but you know, I agree. I mean, I think it's absolutely one of the most important things, if not the most important things in this country to tackle.
Yeah, and just real quick, this is Jack, guys. This is a time of year when, you know, college graduates, they graduate, they go off their parents' insurance, they go off their student insurance, and they go without insurance. And those graduates who are fortunate enough to get a job think that they are young and invincible, and they can go 90 days without a health insurance plan. And it's a scary thought, because there are so many of us who were diagnosed at a time when we were,
you know, in a window like that, or we were just without insurance, and then all of a sudden, bam, we have these office visits, we have a CAT scan, we have chemo, and everything else that goes with it. And you know, if anybody out there knows anyone who's graduating from college and thinks that you know they need to be told go get insurance, definitely tell them because it's important.
Absolutely. Sorry, Brandon, I'm blabbing during your segment here. I should shut up.
No, it's all good. I think
terrible friend, Glenn. Terrible friend.
Well, I mean, you guys are right on track. There's no question that you know if you can't get in the door, you're never going to get to the diagnosis. So.
Yeah.
Well, I guess just hopping off on what Glenn was talking about before, you know, like again, they're talking about the activation of a culture for a cause it didn't know it had the power to control or have influence over.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, I think there's a couple of big themes there. I mean, one is that you know, young adults need to think about their health, period. You know, people talk about, I'm sure you've all heard the example of, you know, nobody doesn't have car insurance, right? Because it's part of what they understand is you know.
But isn't also illegal to not have car insurance?
Exactly.
There's that mandatory word.
Right? Yeah.
I think from the medical profession side, I think we don't do a great job of picking the right messages. You know, I mean, if you go, if you just, you know, take a look at what came out today in terms of, you know, quote unquote health news, most of it is garbage. Most of it is, you know, some studies suggested some link here that, you know, next week or next year is going to be the opposite. We don't pick our messages very carefully. Even in terms of screening, you know, considering cancer, you know, no offense to Glenn, but bloodshot eyes is not going to lead most people to a diagnosis, right? So that's probably going to be one of the messages we should get out there. But, you know, weight loss, night sweats, and, you know, there are certain things that are more red flags that we need to be sure to focus on sort of high yield symptoms and scenarios, because I think we sort of cry wolf a lot, and you do that over and over again, and then you get ignored.
Yeah, and just to clarify, it wasn't the and I'll kick your ass later. It wasn't bloodshot eyes that was my symptom. It was literally the fatigue. There was weight loss. There was night sweats. I was describing all this stuff, and it was just that sort of last one that was like, hey, why don't you go see another doctor? And
I'm just picking on you. I read your book. I know the whole story.
I owe you money, don't I?
Yeah, I went to the doctor for my bloodshot eyes, and he just sent me home and told me I was Irish.
Well, there's a great question coming from Michelle Hastings right now in the chat room. She said, what would be the best way to approach doctors and nurses, med school maybe, about our cause? How do we convince them that this is a true issue? What do you guys think?
Yeah, you know, the Livestrong Young Adult Alliance, which I co-chair with Heidi Adams from Planet Cancer, is now, 110 or 120 organizations. And so I think we're all trying to brainstorm what's our sphere of influence and how do we reach them. So we're talking to large professional societies, you know, who accredits the training for nurses or social workers or physicians, and how do we get into those curriculum and those accreditation programs to say you can't be licensed unless you've had this education.
Well, I think it's a really good point for all of us in listener land to know is that there's a lot of fantastic work that's going on behind the scenes, and that, you know, for example, Planet Cancer is not just a social networking site, but it's Heidi Adams, you know, knocking down doors saying, hey, you know, we need to look at continuing education credits and how do we get doctors educated, nurses educated. You know, when you said there are 110 or 20, what they're up to now, organizations and the Young Adult Alliance, that, you know, when we hear the word, like, policy, it sounds really scary and confusing, and what are we talking about? But these are the kinds of issues that are really important for us as patients to become educated on and know that there is a whole team of folks who are working and brainstorming on how to tackle these issues so that those who come after us don't have to walk the same road that we did.
Well, I think one of the other big steps is to actually get patients and patient advocates together with doctors and researchers, you know, like a forum like this, so that you know, we can hear and understand each other's perspectives on what what's broken and how we're going to fix it together.
Kumbaya.
Well, and just a real quick note here. I have to do this. Heidi Adams and Planet Cancer broke 4,000 members this week, so they get a...
All right.
So congratulations to Heidi and Planet Cancer on their 4,000th member.
Woo!
Wow, Heidi has a lot of relatives, eh?
Yeah, right. Well, we got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to run over, of course. This is probably one of the more compelling conversations we've had on this broadcast. And do you guys have any specific things you want to... I mean, there's no tying this up in a nice little bow because everything's kind of screwy right now. But in terms of, you know, I guess, Carol, have any questions? I could probably think of something.
Hey, I can tell you the single biggest thing you guys can do, buy Glenn's book.
Okay.
Well, I do want to maybe wrap this up with a bit of proactive patient information via the story of my experience of going to the doctor today. I personally have been having a hard time eating for the last 3 weeks maybe. Something is wrong. There's something going on digestively that is just wrong. And so I went to the doctor. I talked to him about it. I said, no, you know, it's probably IBS. What? It's probably just your colon. And, you know, they kind of like moved on to the next thing. And put some more fiber in your diet. Okay, put some more fiber. And he said, you know, I don't want you to think that I'm saying to you, you know, you're young, you're a woman, you're a hypochondriac, but it really probably is stress. So I kind of let it slide for a little bit. And right before we were about to, you know, wrap it up and he was going to send me out the door, I said to him, because I know where my colon is, and this is not what's hurting it. But, you want to feel around where my liver is a little bit? You know, how does that feel to you? And he felt my liver, and he said, you know, your liver feels fine. And I said, well, you know, that's where the pain is. I'm pretty sure this isn't my colon. And I said, you know, what do you think? And what are some other ways that we could maybe check this out? You know, and so I did end up walking out of there with an order form to go get an ultrasound of my liver. But it took persistence. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just taking his word and saying no, but, you know, I know my body. I know where my colon is. I know where my liver is. And to be able to question our doctors in a way in which they're going to be willing to listen, you know, so it's not just like sitting there stewing and or screaming, but trying to finesse a dialogue where we can be taken seriously.
Hey, Brandon, I have a question here. And this is something coming out of complete left field, at least as far as my understanding of what could possibly be an answer. But do you think that the up-and-coming next generation of doctors that are your age and younger will be more open to communications with patients and maybe not so, you know, God-complexy like a lot of the 67-year-old doctors that are out there?
Well, I mean, Hello?
Yeah.
I think that patients in general are definitely going to be way more empowered. I think with personal medical records, people are going to own a lot more of their data. And, yeah, I think that the dynamic's going to change.
All right. I'm happy with that answer.
I'm not happy with that answer.
So, Glenn, have we lifted your spirits even in the slightest bit?
You know, honestly, not really. I've been sort of contemplating suicide for a while. I just figured because I think there's a book in that.
Well, you do live in Seattle. Isn't that like a way of life?
Well, I figured it would be a great story for someone to write if I fight to survive 4 cancers and then I kill myself. You know, it's actually funny. My internist said to me, you know, I was having problems sleeping a while back for stress reasons. She said, let me give you 3 or 4 Xanax or something. And she said, you're not going to take them all at once, are you? And I said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I just fought my ass off to survive these cancers. Nah, I'm just gonna kill myself at this point. So, and I did try. It didn't work out.
Failing at suicide, that's got to be a letdown.
Oh, my God, it's a huge
self-esteem. That's a sign you can't do anything
killer.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Cancer's the least of my worries.
All right, gentlemen. Well, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. Clearly,
thank
we have
you,
to have you back because this has been one of the better dialogues we've had, and I guess, Glenn, I'm not the most optimistic person on the planet, but you make me look fabulous, so thank you for being a disenfranchised asshole, because we love you for it.
Hey, that's going on my tombstone. I like that.
Nice, nice. You get the Matthew Zachary seal of disapproval.
Perfect.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Carol,
Thanks, guys. Any last words?
Thank you very much.
And he laughs, so I'm speechless.
Wow, okay.
Wow.
There was a Reuben.
For once, I heard that back.
There was a Reuben in the studio, wasn't there?
A Reuben?
Yes,
yeah, Emily Reuben.
Yeah, see, that's another Jew. You said they were, you know, you said you were the only one there.
No, no, there's three. We're three against two. It's my wife,
right,
Emily,
right,
and me versus Jack and Annabelle. So
is Jack in the studio, or is he calling in?
No, I'm here. I'm right next to him.
Yeah.
All right.
I make like him look good standing next to him. You make him look good as far as attitudes go.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. We're a hell of a combo. We can go walk for three in a row together. It'd be nice.
All right, gents. Well, all right. Glenn Rockowitz and Dr. Brandon Hayes Latin, thanks, guys, for being on the show. I can't wait to have you back. This is really phenomenal. So thanks so much. Be well and have a great evening.
Thank you.
All righty. Okay, so Carol, certainly the dialogue worth having. I like when these things get a little uppity.
Yeah, I like it too.
Good stuff.
It was a good show tonight.
Now, you are going to be with us next week or not? I forgot.
I haven't made up my mind yet.
Oh, okay, okay.
Oh, no, I'm going to be with you guys next week.
Okay, because was it the sixth? Wait, what's next? What is next week? I've lost track.
Next
Monday?
Week is June 22nd.
Okay, so you'll be here. You're talking about July 6th show.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well.
June 22nd, and our show next week is what is our show next week?
Our show next week is about, it's called All Young Adult Diseases Suck. And it's about how, regardless of what type of disease you have, getting it in your 20s and 30s sucks, regardless of what it is.
I agree. I've been having this huge dialogue about this on my blog lately, and I have a blog post called Widening Beyond the Cozy Cancer World, and I think it's pretty much unanimous that we have a hell of a lot to learn from people who don't have cancer.
All righty. Well, on that note, we'll see you back here next week, my friends, and it's time for our closing sequence. Take care, guys.
Adios.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Prepare to activate.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
And so, to all of you, a fond farewell.
Hooray, I'm helping.
You are a meathead.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.
All right, folks, that's tonight's show. I hope you had as much fun as we did poking a stick at stupid cancer.
Love.
I'd like to thank our guests, Astrid Nicastri, Glenn Rockowitz, Brandon Hayes Latin. And as we said before, next week's show, All Young Adult Diseases Suck. In our survivor spotlight, Yosef Eliezeri, young adult survivor of AML. Amy Tenderich, founder of Diabetes Mine. And a freelance health care blogger. Adam Sadowski, IBD patient, founder of IBD Support Foundation. Sure to be a hell of a show. Same bat time, same bat channel, folks. Remember, if you missed any of our previous shows, just listen to the archives at stupidcancershow.com or subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. iTunes.com. Remember, if it's not stupid, not cancer. We'll see you all back here next week live from the chemo deck. Jack Bucard, Carol Rosenthal, Captain Stubby, and I wish you all a great evening. Go to bed, Heidi. Fucker out.
Won't hurt anymore. It's an open smile.